What motivates NIMBYs? Today on The Curious Task, I'm talking to Eric Merkley. Welcome to The Curious Task, a podcast about politics, philosophy, and economics from a classical liberal perspective. My guest today is Eric Merkley. Eric is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Toronto and co-author of the paper, Housing for Me, But Not for Thee, Values-Based Motivation of NIMBYism in Canada, which is going to be the basis for our conversation today. Eric holds degrees from Wilfrid Laurier, McGill, and UBC, and he also attended a number of ILS events as a student. So it's a great pleasure for me to have him on the show with us today. Before I ask our question, Eric, I should probably make sure that everyone knows that NIMBY stands for Not in My Backyard, and NIMBYs are people who oppose new developments in cities on the grounds that it would negatively affect them. Now we have that out of the way, I'm going to ask the question, we'll go wherever the answers lead us. Eric, what motivates NIMBYs?
Well, it's complicated. So I think the kind of classic explanation for NIMBYism is that it's self-interested behavior. So that you have homeowners that are capturing value from their property. And, you know, we've seen real estate prices go up exponentially in Canada and the U.S. And in some other countries. And it's delivering windfalls to homeowners. And any effort to deal with housing supply, to increase that supply, lower prices, to help new prospective homeowners is going to come at their expense to some degree. And so some of it is profit driven and self-interested behavior. But that's not everything. There's caveats to even that narrative. So yeah, your house value might go up in this new reality, but you're also stuck with much larger property tax bills. And that can be hard to manage in the short run, even if it benefits you in the long term. So there are some kind of caveats to that narrative, but I think that's the kind of dominant way of viewing NIMBYism. But a different approach is to think about NIMBYism as place defense. That is, there are people in society that have place-based identities, strong connections to their neighborhood, that are motivated by a number of different considerations, and we talk about some of them in our paper. And that NIMBYism is that defensive strategy, the protection of that place-based identity. We can unpack what that means exactly. But for us, it's rooted in identities and values, not just kind of profit and self-interested behavior.
Great. Before we go on to talk about those values, I think perhaps it's interesting to set some context. Many of our listeners are in Canada, but many are not. We have a housing crisis in this country, and I think anyone who is in Canada is well aware that we have that, but people outside may not be aware of the scope. Can you say a little bit about how serious the housing crisis is in Canada?
Yeah. Well, if you want to buy a house in, say, Toronto, Vancouver, you're looking at well over $1 million starting, depending on the neighborhood. And even, you know, thinking about the spillover effect, this is especially true after the COVID-19 pandemic. So my hometown and Kitchener-Waterloo, an extended commuting distance from Toronto, but it's still a bit of a stretch. And you're looking at, for a house, $900,000, $700,000 to $900,000, depending on the area, which is unheard of in that area. So it's not even just concentrated in the cities. I had a friend of mine that just bought a house in a rural area outside of Barrie for $800,000. So the house crisis contagion has spread well beyond the major cities. And so, I see a chatter on Twitter, we'll just move where houses are more affordable. And those areas are shrinking in Canada at a dramatic pace. I tend to think matters are worse in Canada than the United States comparatively. There are still pockets in the U.S. where prices are reasonable. But that is rapidly becoming not true in Canada.
Absolutely. One thing I think we're seeing increasing discussion of is people are becoming aware, people who are parents or grandparents, that their children are really struggling to buy homes near them. They would, of course, like to see their children and especially their grandchildren. And for those families to move further away could be a problem. Those people are often baby boomers, and baby boomers hold a lot of political weight still in Canada. And so you might think that there would be a big impetus to solve the housing crisis, or at least improve the housing crisis, based on those factors. And yet these sort of NIMBY values that you describe in the paper perhaps seem to come in stronger or be more prominent.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think it's a matter of, like, one thing we do find in our paper is that most people aren't NIMBYs, and most people aren't opposed to new housing. And in fact, so I don't think I gave you an updated version of the paper, but we also have data in the U.S. now. And so we can compare the two countries in their support for housing. And Canadians are even more supportive of housing, new housing, than Americans are. And so NIMBYism and hostility towards housing, it's not that it's most people. The issue is that the people that are there are most vocal and the most motivated to get their way, kind of concentrated benefits, dispersed costs sort of situation, where even though they're in the minority, they have outsized influence. You know, they're the ones that show up to city council meetings and local government, consultations to have their voices heard, where others who might, want to solve the housing crisis, they don't have the incentive to mobilize in the same way. And so that I think is a big part of the story. It's not that most Canadians are hostile. In fact, most people across the partisan divide want to deal with this issue. It's just that, opposition is pretty concentrated and pretty mobilized.
That's great. As we move through the conversation, I'd love to speak a little bit more about comparing Canada to the U.S. in your new paper, and then also potential solutions as we get to the end. But before we go there, in your paper, you talk about four sort of values that you look at in terms of determining the motivation of those people who are NIMBYs. Can you take us through those?
Yeah. So the first thing is that we focus some of our attention on general hostility towards housing close to our survey respondents, and their opposition or support for local development. So those are one set of indicators. And then we have another set of indicators that are about policy. So whether they are kind of market-led solutions like repealing single-family zoning, or state-led solutions to the housing crisis, like taxes on vacant homes, like things like that. So those two measures are separate, and we see different things for the first package than the second. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So our expectations, grounded in this whole theory of place defense and place-based identities, that, changes that are brought out. So, in a context of high immigration, changes, new housing, is going to, for some people, trigger considerations about who's going to be moving into the neighborhood. And that might be threatening to their place-based identity. And so, one thing that we see is that nativism matters quite a bit in shaping NIMBYism and opposition to housing that's proximate to our survey respondents. So nativism being kind of a privileging of the interests of native-born Canadians over others. In the U.S., we also look at a concept called racial resentment. And so this is basically kind of a measure that elicits how white Americans feel about African Americans in particular, and the policies they're willing to implement to assist African Americans in realizing social equity. And we find that matters in the United States at shaping opposition to local development. And so again, this is all from the lens of concern about who's going to be moving into my neighborhood, that people have kind of an idealized sentiment about what that neighborhood looks like. And for nativists and those that are highly racially resentful, it looks a certain way. It is whiter than many diverse cosmopolitan centers in Canada and the U.S. And so that motivates their opposition to new housing. We also look at moral traditionalism as well. And so this is kind of a idealization of the nuclear family, traditional social structures, and we argue single family homes, and new housing changes those sorts of dynamics. So in the U.S., it's often you'll hear Republicans speak about Joe Biden's war on the suburbs, because there's this idealization of single-family homes having very large properties and all this, which is going to come under threat when you build new homes, when you build apartment buildings or low rises or multifamily homes, it'll put pressure on that idealized community. And so again, it activates that place-based defense mechanism that we're talking about. And so nativism, racial resentment, moral traditionalism, parts of the conservative coalition that get threatened by new housing. And so that plays a role in motivating opposition to housing. And for traditionalists, it also leads them to oppose pro-housing policies, whatever the direction. So those are that dimension of values. But we also talk about egalitarians and free marketers and our expectations for them. So egalitarians being those that want public policy to equalize economic outcomes across society, free marketers that don't see a strong role for the government in managing the economy. And our expectations for them are less about support or opposition to local housing and more about the policies that are implemented to deal with the solution. And so what we see is that free marketers are generally not very supportive of state-led solutions to the housing crisis, but they are very supportive of market-led solutions, like repealing regulations, zoning rules, those sorts of things. And egalitarians, although we expected some divergence where egalitarians were less in favor of market-led solutions and more in favor of free market solutions, they're actually just more in favor of pro-housing policies across the board. And so our argument kind of post hoc is that egalitarians are outcome focused, that they want to solve the housing crisis regardless of what mechanism is used to do that. Whereas free marketers are concerned about the process too and how that's realized. And so those two value dimensions, we argue, are really important in understanding what sorts of policies people are willing to tolerate.
Right. You've talked a little bit there about two values that are going to be associated, at least in Canada, with the Conservative Party or Conservative parties, nativism and traditionalism, yeah, and how those might make people more NIMBY. However, you also talked about free market orientation, and at least many people would associate that with the Conservative parties. Yeah. So politically, how does this play out? Are NIMBYs left, right, in between, all over?
Yeah. We think kind of on average, NIMBYs lean to the right. But we argue this because those cultural conservative dimensions, moral traditionalism and nativism, are just more important for the conservative coalition than free market values. And this is probably something that wouldn't shock listeners, because when conservative parties come into power, they're very much not free marketers in any meaningful sense of the word. And they're responding to their base, because their base really on average isn't animated by those concerns. And so you do see some divide in the conservative movement on these questions, separating cultural conservatives from free marketers. But their elites have more incentive to play to one side of the coin than the other, which is why it's, and we see that kind of tension in the behaviors of different party leaders. So on the one hand, you have Pierre Poilievre, who is taking very much a YIMBY stance. So yes, in my backyard. And is maybe short on details, but at least rhetorically is saying all the right things about this, which is very different than Republicans in the United States. But on the other hand, conservatives that are in government right now are having a much harder time squaring that. And so Doug Ford, he leans a little bit towards building more housing, but actually multifamily homes will threaten neighborhood character. And so he's wishy-washy. And I think that reflects, he is in a position of power and he is also in a position to deliver policy that might divide his base. And so because of that, he's kind of stepped back from a lot of his pro-housing positions from earlier on. And so, again, I think this reflects the tension within the conservative movement over some of these questions. The left is not nearly as divided on average.
Maybe a year and a half ago or so, I was speaking to a housing activist who was more on the political right. His analysis of the situation was that because conservative voters tend to be more rural and suburban, left-wing voters will tend to be more urban. He thought that it would take a conservative premier, a conservative government to sort of get rid of things like single family zoning within cities, because parties like the Liberals and the NDP would be more dependent on the votes for people who might oppose those in an imbued fashion. However, it doesn't quite seem like that's the way the politics are playing out in Ontario. So what do you think of that analysis?
Yeah. I don't entirely disagree with it, in the sense that, we have a lot of political science scholarship that suggests that that party leaders are able to kind of bring their supporters along to support the policies that they want. And they're able to do this in overcoming pressures of, values and all this stuff. They're able to overcome those sorts of dynamics. And so, if Doug Ford, put a stronger line on housing and embraced it fully, and the need to increase housing supply, regardless of what that supply looks like beyond just more and more sprawl of single family homes. I think that would help matters quite a bit. Nixon goes to China sort of thing. So I don't necessarily disagree with it. But I would say that, on the left, it is true that in urban centers, you have stronger dynamics here because in a rural area, it's mostly about sprawl. In an urban environment, it's about high rises and other build types that are more hostile. But at the end of the day, we can't really draw a line. Like, the wealthy homeowners that even in urban centers are really opposing housing are cultural conservatives. So in urban centers, in our data, even if you focus on urban centers, that's the same story still remains. And so I think what we've seen is that parties on the left realize they have more scope to move more aggressively than they thought they did because of these value dynamics. They maybe didn't anticipate that because they thought about all of this. It's just about maximizing profits. But actually, a lot of their base has their back on the fundamental question, because it is rooted in values.
Yeah. Another area that you've worked in is polarization, both in Canada and the U.S. And it seems, at least, that in our sort of current political atmosphere, it is harder and harder for politicians who come from different parties, different support groups, to work together. One thing I notice when I talk to people who identify as YIMBYs is a good chunk of them are more libertarians, free market types. Mm. And of course, a good chunk of them are people on the political left. And it seems like this is a field ripe for alliance, for building a big tent, where you get some people more on the left, some people more on the right. And we have our differences, but we can all agree that we need more housing, and that should work. Do you think there's potential for a serious YIMBY alliance in Canada?
Yeah. And I think that already exists, and it exists in Canada and the U.S. You see those dynamics in YIMBY organizations, but there are no MAGA types in those organizations, and that kind of reflects the dynamics we're talking about in this paper. So it is a kind of cross-cutting political alliance, but of a very, very different type. And you could argue that, in the U.S. context, that free marketers and that kind of brand of the political right, they just don't really matter anymore. Not in the sense of animating seriously the ideas of conservatives in the United States. But I'm very pessimistic on that front. So it just depends. But at the moment, MAGA rules in the U.S. We've been able to hold that at bay in Canada to a larger degree, and MAGA types have absolutely no sympathy for YIMBYism or anything like that.
You talk about the political right in the U.S., and one of the terms that we hear used to describe them a lot is populism. One of the terms used in the paper is housing populism. Tell us a little bit about your concept of housing populism.
Yeah. So that's an element of that paper that we have temporarily ditched. But we'll return to, it is kind of rooted in that place defense theory, where you identify with your community, you see your community as a people, as a collective good, is under threat from some elite. So that kind of gets to that notion of populism. So political scientists will define populism as kind of believing the virtues of the common people as a collective, as against like some ruling elite that is corrupt and evil. And we argue that that dynamic occurs in neighborhoods too, where people that identify with their neighborhood kind of perceive the people in that neighborhood as a people that are virtuous and good against pressures that threaten them from elites, from immigration, things like that. And so we, you know, we got a little bit of pushback for calling that populism versus something else. So defining it exactly is something that we're going to be thinking about in the next couple of years. But it is all rooted in that place defense mechanism.
One thing we see with populism in the U.S. is a sort of hostility to democracy. Of course, the contested election of January 2021, all of that sort of stuff. And I think that's a real concern, certainly among me, and I suspect among you, the sort of declining strength of democratic institutions, again, both in Canada and the U.S., but especially in the U.S. To push back against that, though, I sometimes think that one of the problems we have with our housing policy is that we try to make it too democratic, that someone wants to build a higher density development, they buy up some single family lots, we invite everybody in the community to come by and give their thoughts on what they think of that development, and we don't actually put it up for a vote, but elected representatives are there, they're cognizant that almost always everyone or almost everyone at the meeting is there because they propose it or oppose the development. And so that strikes me as an issue of too much democracy. How do you feel about that?
So, you know, this is the tricky thing with local consultations, is that you're going to, if you hold them, you're going to get some groups in society that are going to be way overrepresented. They're the ones that tend to have the most financial stake. They're the ones that have the most leisure time and ability to put everything down and attend this sort of meeting. They tend to be highly educated, whiter, affluent homeowners. And so any consultation like this is going to be, you know, entirely slanted in one direction. And that can give policymakers a misleading impression about what their constituents think. And, you know, we've seen this in research in the United States that policymakers are not very good at estimating what their constituents think about any given policy questions. And a large part of the story is that it's because they hear from some groups more than others. And then providing those institutions that don't correct those imbalances, that can pose a problem. And so we need to think much more systematically about institutional design if we're going to have those sorts of local consultations. And so, you know, just to draw attention to things like deliberative polling or deliberative mini publics, or these are concepts in political science where there's more thought put into the structure of who gets represented in these discussions. That is, there's some effort to try to randomize in a constituency or whatever population the target is, so that all groups are represented equally. And so I think, you know, I don't think we need to step away and say, like, certainly we need to move away from whatever this is. But that's not to say that democracy can't play a role in it. It's just that democracy needs, the institutions need to be more robust and more equitable than what currently exists. And then we might be surprised about the results that we get. You might get, you know, because of the inequities of the current process, you might get results that are very, very different. And so I think we just need to be more creative with institutional design on some of these questions. I know it is easier to just say, well, just stop having the consultations. But, you know, something's lost there too. And I do think, you know, within this populist moment, that we do need richer democratic institutions that empower citizens, and top-down elite-centered approaches. You know, maybe that's what's needed to deal with the housing crisis right now. But, you know, that's only going to make things worse down the road as citizens feel like they're excluded from the corridors of power in ways that impact them in their day-to-day lives. So I don't know, maybe that's I'm being weirdly optimistic for me in saying that, but I think we need to explore those avenues.
Sam Bowman was a recent guest on the podcast, and he talks about a proposal over in the United Kingdom, which involves basically sort of limiting who's involved in the consultation process, or at least who gets to really have a meaningful voice, in the sense of making it so that streets and the residents of streets get to upzone their street. I'm actually seeing an example of this in our neighborhood. I live in the south end of Ottawa. There is a high-rise development that's going to go in a bit to the north of me, and my community association has spoken out against this, or at least expressed concerns about traffic and crowding and all those sorts of things. Now, we're not directly in the neighborhood. We're sort of adjacent to it. So under the proposal that Sam talked about, people who basically, it would be the property owners who are looking at selling out and then getting the financial gains when we built more things would be the people who would have the ability to upzone a smaller parcel of land, a single street, a block, or something like that. Hmm. Do you think a proposal like that might have any positive effects in Canada?
I haven't heard of it. So honestly, I'd have to think more about it and what the kind of second and third order consequences are. But I don't have anything intelligent to say about that. Maybe just send me the proposal and I can think more about it.
No problem. I'll send you a link to that. On that sort of issue, you have an interesting insight in your paper about the profits that developers get for these sorts of projects and how that can affect public opinion of projects when they know that a development will be highly profitable for developer. What do Canadians think about this when they learn that a development like this is going to make a lot of money?
Yeah, so we nodded to that as something others can look at, but we don't really show anything one way or the other. In our US study, we did have one element of the design where we randomized how large of a corporation the developer was in kind of shaping whether people supported it or not. We found no statistically significant effect there. So the size of the corporation involved in the development didn't really influence things the way we thought it would. So I'm skeptical about how much it matters. Other work has shown that it matters to some degree. So I think there's uncertainty about how much that matters. I think more than anything, though, from what we see, it is the size of the build that matters and the proximity to the to our survey respondents. Those more than anything are influential.
Okay. Is there a specific size of build that is in some sense optimal in this case? I know that to many people are concerned about supply, we might think the bigger the better. But is it the case that you can't build an 80-story tower and yet 5-story mid-rises work?
Yep. So this is the dilemma. So it is sometimes easier to build high-rises. It's a more efficient use of the land. There are certain areas where they're clustered and you can just add more. But people are much more intensely opposed to high-rise buildings than everything else. And there are only, there's only so many more high-rises that can be built where there are already currently high-rises. And so Canadians in particular are, Americans are more hostile to housing across the board, but they're less responsive to high-rise buildings. Canadians are especially responsive to high-rise buildings. And so I think that we need to think about missing middle housing a little bit more. And, there's been relaxing of the zoning rules in Toronto to try to accommodate this and to build more than just single-family homes everywhere. And so I think that sort of densification is going to be less likely to trigger backlash in general. One thing we thought we might find but didn't find was that nativists and traditionalists would be more disproportionately hostile to high rises because it might code, who there's going to be living in the high rise. It might have racial coding behind it. We didn't find that to be the case, actually, which is surprising. So everybody just agrees that high rises suck. So finding ways to build low-rise buildings, multifamily homes, that sort of housing is probably the way to go if we want to increase supply. We can't just rely on high-rises.
Right. Thanks. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about potential solutions to the housing crisis and what insights your research can give us in how we might solve this problem and address the concerns of NIMBYs. We'll be back in a minute on The Curious Task. The Curious Task is a podcast by the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions and feedback to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. Special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Amy Willis, Chris Rondolo, and Christopher McDonald. Remember to follow us and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to The Curious Task. I'm speaking with Eric Merkley today, and we're talking about the question of what motivates NIMBYs. We've talked a little bit about the values that NIMBYs hold, the political dynamics that are at play. I want to talk a little bit about some of the possible solutions. So one thing that we've seen in Canada that seems to be quite popular politically is foreign buyers bans to stop foreign citizens from being able to buy homes. I think this started first off in Vancouver in British Columbia and has spread to other places. Eric, do you have anything to say about whether these bans are effective and the sort of politics behind them?
Yeah. Well, like I'm not an economist, but I would say that, you know, just from my basic limited knowledge, is that it is dealing with a very, 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 very small part of the problem. And you really just can't get around this issue without dealing with housing supply. And that's not like vacant home taxes. All these things aren't going to get us there. But the politics of it are a lot better. Scapegoating foreigners is always going to be good politics. And you know, one of the implications of this work is that, well, nativists are part of the holdup. You know, people that privilege native born Canadians. People that are racially resentful. So things like foreign buyer bans are going to sell well to the folks that are typically resistant to these policy changes. It's not going to solve anything, but the politics of it are good, and that's why we've seen it.
Another program that we've seen is sort of trying to give credits for first-time home buyers, and either through tax-free savings account, something of that sort of tax credit. Do those programs do anything?
Well, other than fuel demand without dealing with supply. So you don't need an economics PhD to understand how that plays out.
Exactly.
But again, it's good politics. It's good politics. And so we see that. And it's something that can be done. You know, one challenge that federal and provincial governments have is that a lot of these rules are decided by municipalities. And the politics of by fiat saying you can not do this, or we'll punish you somehow. Like the politics of that are pretty dicey in general, even if the public supports the ultimate goal. And you can imagine the dynamics like of local mayors pushing back against federal and provincial overreach. And these are the tools that these levels of government have that can sell well, but ultimately aren't going to do anything.
Yeah. One thing that the provincial government here in Ontario has sort of tried, not just to address this problem, but partially this problem, is the strong mayor powers that Doug Ford has introduced to give mayors, I think now in most Ontario cities, or at least the big Ontario cities, additional powers.
Yeah.
Is this effective at all in terms of trying to fix some of the broken political dynamics we see?
Yeah. It really just depends on what the sympathies are of the strong mayor in question, but theoretically it could help matters if local NIMBYs are able to capture their city council members and they have more reason to be responsive to those interests, because like we talked about that they're just much more mobilized. They're the ones that are going to vote in local elections. So it could circumvent that issue to some degree. Has that played out in practice in any meaningful way? I don't think so. But that's more outside my area of expertise, so I can't say for sure. Theoretically, it could help. It's not going to hurt in all likelihood. But again, like we talked about earlier, part of the solution is these kind of elite top-down approaches might be good in the short run. But in the long run, we need to find a way of circumventing and changing those local dynamics so that it's not a problem in the first place.
One thing that I sort of see when we look at the housing possible solutions in Ontario is different people opposing different potential solutions. So last year, the provincial government proposed building on the Greenbelt as a way to build more urban sprawl, a lot of people would say, and there may be some drawbacks there, but it was a way to build more houses in an area of the province that desperately needs them. Yeah. And of course, there was pushback from environmental activists and a lot of people about building there. And I worry that there's the number of people who oppose that sort of development. There's another group of people who will oppose, say, getting rid of R1 zoning in a lot of cities where only single detached homes can be built. Is this how do you feel about my sort of concern here that whatever the proposal is, there's going to be this 10 to 20% of very vocal people who oppose it and get it shut down?
Well, you're right. There are value trade-offs here though. And I think it is, there's kind of a similar analogy when it comes to climate policy, that you have some people that are climate hawks who will support any policy that reduces greenhouse gas emissions, whatever the cost, whatever it takes. But there's others that are it depends on the cost benefit balance. And, maybe go the carbon tax route instead of, command and control regulation or something like that. And in the case here, I think it is reasonable. Maybe you can build your way out of the housing crisis by just producing an insane amount of sprawl on top of sprawl. But there are going to be trade-offs for that in terms of lost green space. That lack of densification is going to increase greenhouse gas emissions. Livability of an area is going to be lower when it is just sprawl in general. So I think there are reasonable qualms to be had about going all in on that sort of solution. And because it is easier to build sprawl than it is to densify, that is a convenient escape valve for conservatives in particular to take. So I think it's reasonable to raise questions about that. But on the other hand, opposing all new building in some of these areas seems to also be a bit of a stretch too. So I don't know. I think there's a middle ground to be had here where the focus should be on densification, but you really do need an all hands on deck approach to building as many homes as possible. But people are going to have different levels of comfort depending on where the balance is there. And some of that is also rooted in place-based identity. So, moral traditionalists, building more single-family homes, probably not a big problem for them so much as it is for other people of other value sets. Some of that building can be compatible with the values that some NIMBYs have. So I don't know. There's no easy answer there.
Yeah. We talked a little bit earlier on about the sort of financial motivation for NIMBYs, the idea that, your neighborhood has a bunch of new people come in, perhaps this degrades the character of the neighborhood in some way, and that people may be worried about their housing values. I'm skeptical of that sort of narrative, but I understand a lot of people do hold that. But to me, it seems there's a couple different types of people who might hold a financial stake in their house. One is people who bought a house in Toronto 20 years ago for $100,000. It's now worth $1.5 million, and they've got this really nice retirement fund built up.
Yeah.
There's other people who are going to be in a younger demographic, and they paid $1.5 million for their house. They might have $1.2, $1.3 million mortgage. And if we are able to address the cost of housing by bringing it down in a city like Toronto, bring the median house price down from where it is, those people could be pretty seriously underwater on their mortgage. Yes. I'm curious if there's anything you saw in looking at financial motivations, whether there is a split there, either by measuring it to younger versus older people. Is there any difference between how those people view the cost of housing?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any research that's really looked at that. And that, you know, that first group, like all of those dynamics are, you know, much more exacerbated with how bad things are right now. But yeah, you could imagine that, you know, the accessible homeowners are somewhere in the middle. They don't get the same windfall, but they also aren't going to be entirely underwater if prices come down. You know, my wife and I bought a house in Toronto, and you know, we would be in the same, like, it would be not great if we lost, like, we paid a lot. It'd be not great if prices came down. So yeah, there could be some non-linearity there where accessible homeowners are somewhere in the middle, but I don't, to my knowledge, I don't think anybody's really tested that explicitly, but it makes intuitive sense to me.
Yeah, I've got a friend in San Francisco who was there for about a decade without buying. Of course, the cost of housing in San Francisco is crazy. And so he very much would have been a YIMBY in terms of, we need to address the cost of housing. Eventually, he had a family. They were able to buy a house. And now I know that he's carrying quite a mortgage. And while I'm not sure that he's quite in the NIMBY camp yet, he certainly would have some rational incentives to sort of push him more towards that. I find those politics really interesting. Speaking about San Francisco, you've talked about the fact that you've updated some of the research. You've compared what it's like in the U.S.
Yeah.
And we've talked a little bit about some of those differences. But let's talk more about that. What are some other findings in the U.S. that were different from what you found in Canada?
Yeah. So firstly, mostly it was all the same in terms of like what associations were correlated with NIMBYism and policy and all that. So we saw a lot of similarity across all of that. A few key differences are just, in general, Americans are more opposed to housing. And I think that kind of plays into that there's a stronger ethos about the single family home in the United States, and you know, a privileging of suburban life than in Canada. And in fact, you know, we have this measure in our survey that evaluates people's preference for density. So, would you prefer to live in an area where you can walk to shops, but it's more densely packed and property space is smaller, or do you want larger homes, more space, and you have to drive to to restaurants or shops and all that? And Americans have a stronger preference for less density than Canadians, and so I think that produces some of the difference we see between Canada and the U.S. The other difference is that, you know, Americans are more hostile to homes across the board, where Canada really stands out when they're high rises or when they're very, very proximate. So Canadians are more responsive to build size and the particulars of local housing than Americans are. And then the final thing is, we didn't test this, and so most measures of racial resentment focus on African Americans and are kind of rooted in race-based dynamics that are in the U.S. So we didn't really look at racial resentment in Canada, although we do suspect, and I can talk more about it, how that dynamic might play in some parts of the country. But we looked at racial resentment in the U.S., and it matters quite a bit. And it structures American attitudes towards affordable housing in particular. And so affordable housing is very clearly racially coded. And so if local development is going to be affordable housing or social housing, it really kind of gets the backup of people that are racially resentful. We didn't look at that in Canada. As I said, the measures are not exact, but we do think things like Indigenous resentment can play a role in some areas of the country where development is led by Indigenous Canadians. We see that in the Jericho Lands in Vancouver, for instance. And I think, and one of my co-authors is a grant that we hope to study that dynamic in the coming months. So there are, we do think that has relevance for Canada. We just haven't studied it yet.
Yeah. The Jericho Lands case, as I understand it, is a really interesting example that I expect many of our listeners are not familiar with. Can we take a small tangent, and can you briefly describe what that is?
Yeah. So it is a proposed development on this kind of sparsely populated area of West Vancouver by Indigenous bands, and they really want to densify the area substantially. So there are going to be high rises and mid rises, a mix of housing, but it would be a remarkable increase in density in that part of the city. For those familiar with Vancouver, You know that the western part is just single family homes as far as the eye can see. It really kind of got the backs up of local homeowners because of that change to the neighborhood character. But our co-authors and I suspect that because the developer are Indigenous Canadians, Indigenous resentment might play a strong role in producing opposition to that development.
Yeah. I know that Eric has lived in Vancouver for a while. For those of you who are like me who have visited Vancouver, you may have gone to places like Yale Town and looked, and there are these, you know, condos that seem to reach the sky. It seems like they've got an incredibly dense city. If that's your impression of Vancouver, then I would encourage our listeners to look at an overhead sort of zoning map of Vancouver, where you can see how much of the city land is zoned for high density use versus single family homes. You can also do the same with Toronto, because if you're in downtown Toronto, it seems like a very dense city. When you zoom out and sort of take that view, I think it makes it a lot more apparent the problem that we have with restricting large portions of our major cities to only single family homes.
I had an apartment building at the top. I had an apartment at the top floor, 22nd floor of a high rise close to High Park, which is in West Toronto. And you could look off my balcony, and as far as the eye could see, you would see nothing but single family homes all the way to Pearson Airport. Just absolutely nothing, as far as the eye can see, and that's outside of the downtown core of Vancouver. It's very similar story in Vancouver as well.
Yeah. Well, Eric, we're coming to the end of our time, but as we sort of work towards our conclusion, I'd love to know what it is that you've discovered through your research and work in this area that might serve as sort of a guidepost to politicians or public policy measures that might improve this. Yeah. You know, as we start to understand what motivates NIMBYs more, I'm hoping that part of the lesson is to be able to address those concerns, to overcome them, and really address the housing crisis in Canada. What can you say about some recommendations if the premier or the prime minister were to call you up and ask you how we can use this understanding to address the problem? Yeah. What would you say?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, generally we need to be attuned to how we communicate and how we message about certain policies. And you know, the ideal would be to try to bring more people into the tent to want to build housing in their local communities, and to support policies that would allow that to occur. And the reality is that a big stumbling block are nativists, those that are racially resentful, moral traditionalists. And they, you know, they are one of the groups that you'll need to persuade. And conservative leaders are in a particular bind, because that's a very important part of their base. And so it's about kind of selling the message in a way that can appeal to those sorts of voters. I think we see that a little bit with how Pierre Poilievre is talking, and he's kind of tied in housing with a populist message, and that message probably does have a fair amount of appeal. We need more research to see if this is working the way we think it might, but it might have quite a bit of appeal to groups that are typically resistant to new housing. But they are not going to be persuaded by equity concerns and left-leaning talking points on all of this, and so you gotta communicate the message to those that are resistant, and I think Pierre Poilievre is doing that. So studying those dynamics, I think, is really important. And two, you know, thinking about, you know, what kind of housing is more likely to trigger opposition and not, again, that the focus on the missing middle housing and multifamily homes and low rises. It's probably we didn't find a connection between these builds and values, but I think we need more research to be sure on some of those questions. So intuitively, I think that style of housing is less threatening to people that hold those place-based identities. And so thinking about ways that we can't just be all in on high rises all the time. We have to diversify the housing mix. And that'll likely appeal to people in important ways. And again, fixing local institutions so they're not entirely dominated by wealthy, privileged homeowners, finding other ways of consultation that engage with more people and including renters in the mix too, who are massively underrepresented in these sorts of consultations. That also needs to happen as well, because we can't, it might be fine to rely on, top down federal to municipal, provincial to municipal directives, tying funding to increasing how, but all of that's going to rub people the wrong way to some degree, and it takes the power out of the hands of local communities, and so that might not be sustainable in the long run. And so we need to find ways of fixing local institutions so that they can deal with these important inequities. So some of it's policy related, but other is it's thinking about politicians and what they can do. Just try have a consistent pro-housing message and find ways to bring other people into the tent, and you do that by appealing to their values.
We've touched a little bit on sort of the public choice theory, at least some ideas from public choice theory in our conversation about how politicians will respond to what their voting base wants and be sort of driven that way. And that's certainly a model that I find convincing and think about the world a lot that way. But you've also mentioned the sort of idea of political entrepreneurship, that political leaders can sort of bring their followers along and speak in favor of an idea. For anyone who's been watching the polls in Canada, it seems very likely that our next federal government will be a conservative government. And then I think perhaps the big question is, which is more powerful, the sort of nativist, traditionalist, wanting to defend place sentiments that might be within a conservative party government versus a leader, as you say, who seems to be willing to spend some political capital on pushing for that in going in the right direction. Are you optimistic that a conservative federal government taking office in next year would generally push in the right direction?
When he is in government with a conservative party and they have to actually make policy decisions that affect people instead of just being able to bludgeon Trudeau again and again and again with kind of populist rhetoric and all that, when he gets to be blamed for policies, I do not know how sustainable it is. And we can see that with Doug Ford, who's now like wishy-washy on housing. So I don't know. Maybe he's laying the groundwork for like more durable YIMBYism, and so that it's not, but we see conservative parties, once they got in office, pursue policies that are very, very different from the rhetoric that they supported. Sometimes that's a good thing, but in this case, it wouldn't be. So I don't know. Who can say?
Wonderful. It's a tricky thing. I always try to tell people not to put faith in politicians, and you'll never be disappointed. Sometimes you might be pleasantly surprised, although I don't find too many of those occasions. We are wrapping up towards the end of our time, but I do want to give you the chance to have the last word. And of course, you've written this paper, done this research on sort of what motivates NIMBYs, the values that motivate them. And I'm a big believer in the propagation of ideas, spread of ideas. A lot of it takes place based on sort of one-on-one or small group conversations. And I do think we have a dynamic in this country where a lot of young people are inclined to be more YIMBY because they would like to have a place that in a neighborhood, in a city where they would like to live when they're talking to people who are a generation or two older who might have those concerns. So the closing question I want to finish on is, do you have any advice or what advice can you give to anyone who's speaking to someone? And again, they may well be older, although it doesn't have to be that dynamic, but someone who is a YIMBY, someone who's been banging their head against the wall with their uncle for multiple Thanksgivings, trying to get the sort of, combat the NIMBY idea. What do you think is the most effective way to do that?
Yeah. So there are things that aren't going to be effective. One takeaway from this paper that might be, easy to latch onto and to take it in the wrong direction is, NIMBYs are just racists. And so you can just kind of use that label around to talk about NIMBYs. But that's not going to persuade anybody. Like that's going to make things worse by getting people's backs up. So I don't want that to be the takeaway, that you're just going to use that word and kind of tar everybody that has some skepticism towards housing. We see associations that are meaningfully sized and modest, but it is not a deterministic relationship. And there's other things at play. People do have deeply rooted connections to their place, and we have to respect that to some degree. And so that means when you have these conversations, to not talk down, to not throw charged labels at these people, and to talk about how, you know, their idealized community can still be realized with more housing, and to point out to the struggles of younger people, young families, that are not able to, you know, to have affordable, sustainable housing. You know, that, you know, for traditionalists that care about family values, all of that stuff should matter quite a bit. So speak to those concerns and don't talk down to them. And so that would be my recommendation, is to not use the findings of this paper or anything else that comes out as a bludgeon. Instead, try to find a way to appeal to these concerns, because place-based identities do matter.
I think that's great advice on this, and also generally good advice on when you want to sort of convince someone or bring someone around or a little closer to your way of thinking.
It's really not rocket science, but unfortunately we drop the ball on this all too often, especially on social media.
We can always get better at it. Eric Merkley, thanks so much for joining me today on The Curious Task.
Thanks for inviting me.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Sabine Alchidiak and Eric Sege. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Vopenfjord. You should check out his music online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it, and listeners like yourself. I'm Matt Buffton. Thanks again for joining us on The Curious Task.